Asterix, welcome to another episode of Ad Aster. We're super happy to be here today. I'm Emma, and this is...
I'm Selena.
And today we're going to be talking about some reflections, thoughts, and poems of our issue 10 theme, Lacuna. So, Selena, would you like to get started and start talking about the history and meaning of Lacuna?
Yeah, so lacuna is a super cool, interesting word that is defined by an unfilled space or interval or a gap, and it's often used to describe writing with missing pieces. Now, what's really interesting is it descends from the Latin word lacus, meaning lake. And what's really beautiful about bodies of water and lakes in general is we often don't know what they're hiding or what's under the surface, which I think relates to a lot of unknown pieces in writing.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think just the image of a lake is so interesting because there's the water and then there's the space that it fills, which is a gap in and of itself. And I feel like it kind of curves with the word lacuna too. So I think that's just a really interesting background of the word.
I definitely agree. And I like what you said about like how the space that it takes up, like this body of water or the lake, because where I'm from, we have this lake where actually beneath it is a town that, the government basically paid all these minority people to leave so that they could fill with water. So it's like this entire piece of history that's removed, which reminds me of a lot of like texts that we now try to translate or discover when we're doing like archaeological exhibits or we're studying ancient texts. There's so much we don't know, and all we get is these like vague translations into English, if even that. So I just think it's beautiful that it comes from a word that means lake.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that's so purposeful of them. Like, they chose to do that. The government chose to do that. And I think a lot of people in translation and in writing, we choose to, like, even writing in and of itself, we're trying to express something that we're feeling or isn't really put into words. So I feel like even the process of putting down words maybe is, there's always going to be a missing piece that you can't fully write down. So I think it's interesting, like the way we try to conceptualize our experience, but knowing we can't fully conceptualize anything because the way we experience it and the way we express it is always going to be different or have a gap.
Yeah, it's like my favorite, like when people describe writing, my favorite is when they always bring up translation, even if you're not going from one language to another, because like there's always something lost and you're turning something like abstract into something concrete, like the act of putting words on paper to me is a very concrete action, but just like memory or experience is so like out there. It's like we're always going to lose a piece of something no matter how hard we try.
Yeah, especially with the context. Like you can't, I was thinking about like history and monuments lately, and like you can have the same monument that you had like 300 years ago, but it wouldn't mean the same thing because of the context now. And so we often see monuments or statues as like not very ethical in today's era when they're perfectly fine like 300 years ago. And that's because the context around the thing has changed. So it's maybe it's not even the physicality of it. It's not even the physical thing, but also what's around it that creates something that's missing.
Yeah, like the idea of something like throughout history, even if the idea doesn't change, the way we perceive it does. Even if it's not maybe about ethics, but just how we interpret what an author was trying to say. Like, there's so many authors who died and then it was like a family member who published their work. And we can't really ask that author, what were you trying to say? What were you feeling? And we're almost left to interpret it or translate their words to our own minds. And from that, I feel like we almost lose a piece of it too.
Yeah, I definitely agree. But the thing is, everything is kind of perception. Like, even if we're not actively trying to translate or actively trying to read or interpret, just the way we view the world is from our lens. And so maybe we can't ever unlock some like objective truth or some objective way of seeing the world. It's just tinted by how we see it. And maybe that naturally blocks out a piece of whatever we're trying to look at.
And I guess that leads me to think is like, can you have gaps in what you know about something and still like feel like it's something you can understand? Like, how much do you need to know about something, or how unbiasedly do you need to perceive it to understand it fully? Or can you even understand it fully?
I kind of feel like you can't understand it fully. Like, I feel like no one can understand it fully. It's just, you understand, I don't know, but there's so many ways of understanding things. You can understand them really sharply, like one point, understand it really deeply, or have a really large survey of things. But I think ultimately we're still trying to approach trying to understand it fully, but it's not something we can ever get to.
So then maybe should we start trying to understand things just for like pieces, or should we keep trying to understand things from like their like entirety? Or is like really the only way, that we're going to try to remove those gaps is from just trying to get pieces of it?
I guess it's like what we want from the thing we're trying to look at, right? Because a philosopher, I think Kierkegaard, he has this way of writing where he writes under a lot of different like pseudonyms, and he was kind of talking about how he has to write under the pseudonyms because the only way to really interpret his message is to piece together all the missing pieces and to piece together all the different parts and to try to figure out their correlations. And that's so much more an effective way of teaching his philosophy than just telling someone straight up. So maybe it is in the lacuna and the gaps and the way we interpret them or try to connect them where we actually learn how to truly understand something.
And I guess I'm wondering, like you said, Kierkegaard, he purposefully broke up his writing, right? So you would understand it better. It reminds me of how some writers purposefully do not include information, or they remove information to make the reader understand the message better. Like, you know, erasure poetry, blackout poetry, poetry with purposeful gaps, or even just not telling your reader everything outside of the form, but just the content. I think there's something really important and beautiful to that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That reminds me of Daniel Liu's poem, Someday I'll Love Redacted, where it's after Ocean Vuong, Someday I'll Love Ocean Vuong, but he chooses to not say his name, or he chooses to say, like, bracket redacted instead of his name. And in the author's note, he says he wants to separate, like, himself, the speaker, and the person being spoken to, because talking about yourself or talking about your body is a very, very different task, and it needs that kind of distance to see it more clearly.
I think this is a very like beautiful way to like look at erasure poetry, because this isn't technically erasure poetry, but it's like the act of the poet erasing himself from a poem about himself. But it's interesting because most of the lines have some form of first person or something to do with his body. Like there's this really beautiful, or just the beginning, redacted, I am only here to hear your last breath. Running water, running lungs, racing like oblivion. Each gun face is just an escape. So already we have one eye identifying himself and three different parts of his body. So I guess it's like, how important was his name to this poem? And I almost feel like the message comes across better because we don't have that information.
Yeah, I feel like it, like he wants to do, it kind of abstractifies it in a way where it's almost easier to understand, because instead of focusing on the name, instead of focusing on who it's to, you're focusing on how he feels about the all of the different parts and how they come together. And I actually think that it's really interesting that you mentioned point of view, because I've often heard that, like, second person, you sometimes write in second person to, like, avoid pain, or you write in second person to, like, not admit something to yourself, which is really interesting to look at, because it's like you create a gap between who you are and the person you're describing to try to understand it better, or to try to, like, express them more honestly. And the way we choose to direct things in our writing is also a way we choose to not direct things at other people or in other ways. And it's interesting to think about how who we're talking to has to do with how much of what we see.
I love that idea of like you use second person to like not feel pain or admit something. Because, you know, you think about when you write second person poetry, you and like second person is often used as a command. But it's almost like even when you're writing you, which is supposed to be directed at your audience, most of the time you're actually writing directed back at yourself. So it's almost like the second person become a mirror of all the gaps that you don't want to admit to yourself, like all the lacunas of your own like words or your own messages or your own mind. Are those like reflected back into your second person writing?
I agree. Yeah, that's so interesting. And also the saying that, like, what you see in others is also what you see in yourself. Like, talking about, like, if someone always praises others for something, it's a quality that they also admire and probably possess, or vice versa, if it's a negative trait. And it's interesting because the way we see the world is so much of a reflection of who we are. So in any way, no matter who it's directed to, as long as it's our expression, it has our faults and it has the way we see the world. So maybe distance is just getting a sharper perspective on how we see things.
And just like we'll never like understand like writing or reading or like any of those things that we said earlier fully, we're always going to understand a piece of them. That's what I think. Like, just like it's a spectrum, and I don't think you can be on one end or the other. I think you're always caught in the middle of understanding maybe a piece, and you're never going to understand none of it, but you're always going to understand some of it.
Yeah, and maybe that's all that matters. Like, maybe we don't really need anything more because we're kind of just pieces of everything as well. We're a piece in our lives, we're a piece in other people's lives, we're a piece in society. And maybe it's okay that we don't know everything. As long as we know something and we have our view of way of seeing the world, it can mean something to us. And maybe someone looking or knowing so many people can summarize lacunas, or we can have philosophy, we can have psychology or social science to just describe how so many different pieces work together. But ultimately, we're still pieces, and those systems can never encapsulate like the specific quirks of each one of us. So there's beauty in being just a piece and not being the whole in and of itself.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to like the beauty of writing that doesn't give you anything. Like as we were saying about erase your poetry, I think that it's like a type of poetry that we don't see as often because I think it's something we do a lot in school as an introduction to poetry. You know, your teacher has you rip out a page of a book and then you just sort of like erase some lines. You're like, oh, I did a poem. But I think it's something that like has so much depth and intent. Like, if you've ever read the essay Erasure in Three Acts, by Mira Leung. And she discusses how she teaches a workshop of eraser poetry, and she refers to eraser poetry as the ghost of the original writing. And when I hear ghost, I think of like only the pieces that matter are left over. Like anytime you hear about a ghost in literature or movie, they're always either carrying around like the one thing they could never complete or the one ultra hardship in their life or something that was the most crucial piece of them. Which is, I think, an interesting perspective to look at erasure poetry through.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Sorry, I thought of a quote and I wanted to search up who it was by, but I didn't find it, but it's okay. But it went something along the lines of, it's not ghosts that haunt us, it's us who can't let them go. And I think that's really interesting in this circumstance as well, because ghosts are the things that we the lacunas, the things we left behind. And those gaps, their absences do haunt us in a way, and it does say so much. But maybe it's us that needs the absences, and it's us that can find the meaning more inside the absences. And so we create them deliberately because we want to hold on to something.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, let's see. In the same essay, she says, in a workshop on erasure poetry, I described erasure as a subversion of the belief that it's poetry's job to reveal. And I think that's interesting and kind of beautiful because it's like when you write something, you become so attached to your words and you become attached to the way your reader is going to interpret them and what you're revealing to your reader. But I think it also goes to say that as a writer, there are some things you can keep to yourself, and sometimes it's good to make your reader question what you're saying. Like, entertain. Like, when you do erase your poetry, why did you choose to not black out those certain words? They'll never know the words you blacked out, but they will know the ones you left behind. And why are those the ones you wanted to reveal to your reader? And why not others? Why are those the ghosts that haunt your writing? And why are you the only one that gets to know the other words?
That's actually really interesting to think about, the way that they can see that the other words are blacked out, but they don't know what they are. But you, as the author, know what you blacked out. I think that's just a really interesting duality, because I feel like, would it be different if the words weren't there? Like, and imagine like blackout poetry, and then imagine poetry where you just remove the words and you smush them together as if there were no gaps. Maybe like the gaps will still be obvious because like the sentences wouldn't sound right, or the sentences wouldn't like flow as well as they did in complete sentences in the first draft. But is there a fundamental difference in knowing the gaps and in knowing that the author purposely, I guess there's like three stages maybe. One stage could be blackout poetry, like a lot of words, you actually take a pen and you black stuff out. So the second stage could be you take the words and maybe there's the gaps between them, but they're just spaces, but you don't see that there's words that have been blacked out. And the third would be you black them out. You've removed the spaces, you just smush them together. I wonder how the way we perceive the gaps influences the message.
I definitely think like the act of like using like black ink over other inks almost makes it appear more final. Like, yes, these words are not coming back. And as a reader, I want you to know that. Because obviously, I think if an author really didn't want you to see the blank spaces, they could definitely publish a work where they're like, this was this piece of writing, but I cut away these pieces. And you could probably maybe find it. But I think there is an importance too. And I think it changes the reader's mindset when they are reading a blackout poem. Because there's also, like, there's, like, ways to read blackout poetry. Like, I would argue it's kind of more difficult than other forms of poetry. And just, like, reading that poem takes more work than reading maybe a poem that isn't blacked out. You also have to work for the information because you're not given all of it. Like, I think one of the most beautiful lessons I ever got was, it's okay to punish your reader. And by punish, I mean it's okay to not give them everything. Like, they're smart, competent human beings. But also, like, make them use their own, like, mind. Make them imagine what those gaps would say. So I don't think it would be the same if you didn't have those black marks there.
Oh my god, okay, I agree. Because in normal editing, you do erase a lot of things. You do delete a lot of things. And the finished product is almost always a put-together version with things left out and things added. But the reader never even gets to see the first draft and never gets to see what's deleted. And I think it's interesting. I don't know if you've heard of, like, the Project Skins by Witcher Tangerine. You have? Oh, yeah. It's part of, like, their joint curriculum, I think. So basically, for Skins, it shows a bunch of writers and their poems, the first draft compared to the second draft compared to the third draft, with the author's commentary on the poems. And it's always interesting because the poems move closer and closer to themselves every draft. And it's like things are deleted, things are rewritten, but things had to be rewritten in order for the final message to be more punchy and more the heart of the poem or the heart of the message they're trying to get at. And it's just so interesting because reading Skins reveal to me that oftentimes what you don't say is what needs to be explored even more. And oftentimes the things you delete are the things that can be said even better in what is now a gap. But maybe one day or in the final draft, it will be something. It will be other words. It will be words that mean more, that is more aligned with exactly what you're trying to say in the poem. So blackout versus revision, like purposefully showing that you edited, purposely showing that you blacked things out versus just letting the poem morph into something and then showing the world the final version. I think it's very different and interesting to look at.
One of the most beautiful things to me about the Erasure in 3x essay is the fact that it does kind of show you that edit. Like, it starts as an essay, right? It starts as an essay describing the act of teaching erasure poetry. And then as soon as you scroll down, you get how she turned her essay into a blackout poem. And then I think from there, she turns it into another blackout poem. She creates two blackout poems from her essay. And I think that goes to show, like, the things that you take away, like what you were saying, those edits. Like, blackout poetry is so versatile, and you can do it so many different ways, and you can take away something different each time and just play with that idea of, okay, what does it say now that I've taken away this? Which is almost, to me, more important than what didn't you take away. Like, why did you take away that? Why was that edit made?
And scrolling through it, I see the line, sometimes what emerges from the eraser is refrain. And I think that goes back to what we're saying. Sometimes what is in the missing pieces or in the missing lacuna is us refraining from saying more or us refraining from going deeper. And so we need to create the gaps in order to have room to get something else out of it.
I agree. And I like that idea of refrain because it's like that poem for Brad who wants me to write about the pyramids. This poem, though, I'm not sure they're taking away. They didn't cut away anything from their actual writing. But this poem is a square, and in the center, there's this giant space that's been taken out that is a square. So it's like a square within a square, kind of. And this poem is about the writer who is Egyptian, and so whoever Brad is informs them that they need to write about these pyramids because he thinks that's what Egyptian culture is. And it's almost like this act of putting this giant square in. I see this square as like what Brad wanted Egyptian culture to be. And then the author surrounds it with everything that it is and everything that it means to them. And so it's like leaving this gap of not saying what Brad wants the author to say is so much more powerful than maybe if they did write a poem criticizing Brad or criticizing this idea. But just having this space to me is so powerful.
I definitely agree. I really like this poem, and especially the square, how it's like almost in the shape of a pyramid. I think it just says so much. And also the way that you have to write around the space, or she writes around the space. Like, once we remove or around this thing that I'm trying to emphasize that I'm purposefully not including is how I actually feel about it. I think it's also interesting to mention that she didn't take out words, like you said, but rather chose to write around it, which means she started out with the idea of creating a gap of sorts. So that intention kind of fuels the piece even more. And in the footnote, it says, the first thing a falsifier or a tourist, an Arab nationalist would do is to have a surfeit of camels, a caravan of camels on every page. But Muhammad, as an Arab, was unconcerned. He knew he could be an Arab without the camels. So he knew he could have his culture without having the pyramids, without having the camels, without having what is so often represented as the culture. And in that, maybe that's the only way we can actually get to authentic culture, by removing these false band-aids of culture, or the false band-aids over the gap, and just leaving the gap to shine and how much it holds in and of itself.
Yeah, and I think this poem has a lot to say of, like, the expectations of what society puts on us as, like, whether as writers or even as our culture. Like, I think everyone has, like, a cultural stereotype. Like, there are some that, like, outwardly we reject, and there are some that almost feel like expectations, like, us of a certain culture should have. Like, I'm Iranian American, so it's like there's this expectation that not only should I speak Farsi, but I should be familiar with every piece of the country, and I should have these strong opinions. It's like, but that's not part of me, so why would I write about that? And I love that in the footnote, they say people who are outside of the culture, like they say a tourist, a falsifier, but they also say an Arab nationalist, which means someone who is intensely proud of their culture. And I think it's almost like when you're so proud of your culture and you love your culture so much, I think you're almost more susceptible to what society thinks about it and who society thinks you should be. Like, maybe because you love your country so much, you should embrace these stereotypes, because that's how the world sees your country. But I don't think that's important. I think that poem says this so nicely.
I agree. It's like when you're drunk on pride of any kind, it kind of blinds you. And you just want to indulge in saying, I am this thing, saying that this is this thing. Like having the period, they're making that statement and not really looking at the cracks, which is really hard, because to define anything is to define what it's not. Like I think I mentioned in my editor reflections, who are we but the people we are not? And making anything a statement and being proud of anything, really, we're carving a space for it. And in carving a space for it, we're leaving something out. I think it's also really interesting how we can also see, like you were talking about this poem as opposed to like the societal expectations. It's interesting to see how people choose to have gaps of the societal expectations. For example, in China, like a year ago, the lying flat movement of people who decided that I don't want to compete in this like really unfair corporate capitalistic like society, I just want to like not do anything because and just live for myself and live like a very like not exactly on the go, but just like not a life where you really have to strive for. And you can also see this in like the I Don't Dream of Labor movement and like other movements, and just and every movement, basically everything we advocate for is a protest, is some sort of gap in our current like society system. And these gaps, can we actually get new voices, and can we realize that maybe our previous system was flawed, or there are ways to improve, and we can hear more voices in the gap?
I love this idea of like flawed system, and like how you keep saying like we are the people that we are not. And I was thinking, like, as you said that, like maybe the reason that we sometimes follow these stereotypes that stick to our culture is because they're positive stereotypes compared to negative ones. Like, this was written by a Middle Eastern person. And obviously, when you say you're Middle Eastern, there's always, like, in the back of a lot of people's minds, like, terrorist, fundamentalist, all these negative stereotypes. Sometimes it's easier. It's like the way a lot of Iranians now say they're Persian instead of saying they're Iranian, because it's like they're forming a gap between this, like, fundamentalism. Like, if I say I'm Persian, people think of cats and carpets. If I say I'm Iranian, I'm not separating myself from this idea of like terrorism or anger or confusion. So, and I like that idea of like protest, like filling in what society doesn't know. Because we've talked a lot about the importance of like gaps and not always saying everything. But I also think there is a reason why we should also strive to fill in these gaps, especially when it comes to communication and how we perceive others and the lives we want to live.
But I guess that also, if everything we do or everything we protest is kind of creating a gap in the system, can gaps really be filled? Should they be filled? Or should we just keep creating more and more gaps in everything that we think is concrete? The more concrete it is, the more gaps it probably has lurking underneath. Should we just constantly think that and constantly create these gaps?
Is protest like creating more gaps or is it filling them? Because I think it kind of does both. I think it creates a gap in between like how you don't want to be perceived or what you don't want from your society. But it may also fill in, like, confusion can be a very good thing, but it also can be one that leads to, like, violence, hatred, all these terrible things. Because to me, sometimes confusion can, like, breed ignorance, right? So I think there goes something to say about both. I think it's good to create gaps that, like, distance yourself from these ideals. Like, we were talking about statues earlier, right? And how so many monuments are being torn down. Maybe it's good that we're creating a gap between the way we used to think and the way we used to talk about others and the way we used to perceive others and the principles that we used to care about. And when we create that gap between principles we no longer agree with, maybe we're filling in a new gap of saying these are the principles we would like to have now. And maybe in the future, people will create a gap from those principles. But I think there is beauty to filling in confusion with new ideas.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And I really like the last point of how sometimes we create gaps to fill them in. And in that way, creating a gap is not inherently just to make an empty space. It's basically an attempt at a new beginning. It's saying, look, we can create this gap, but now we have this gap. It's an opportunity to start again. It's an opportunity to replace it with whatever we want. And that's really beautiful because oftentimes we view gaps as emptiness, but not as potential. Or we view the things that we lose or the things that we've moved on from or the ways that we've changed society as something that we've lost forever. But in reality, it only feels the next generation. It only feels the next train of thought. And we can see this in science and all the ways that maybe Christianity or maybe our conceptions of God kind of, we decided that there's more scientific ideas or there's other scientific ideas that can also explain things. And then we decided to divorce God from science and say that like religion is ascientific as opposed to being opposed to science. And we keep on advancing. We keep on believing things and we keep on advancing in science. Like the Isaac Newton, I think, quote, if I've gone far, it's only because I've stood on the shoulder of giants. So to create gaps in existing systems is to create more opportunities to stand again and again on the shoulders of giants and add yourself to the giants or add yourself to the human tower of things that are ever evolving.
When you said generations, it reminded me of David Chen, our editor-in-chief. He wrote a theme reflection, and in it, he brings up this gap between him and his parents when it comes to language. And he talks about how there is always going to be words that he can't translate, but also there's gaps between generations, upbringings, and time. And, you know, I feel like we talk so much about how we lose parts of our culture, parts of identity between generations. Like, we lose fluency in, like, our parents' native tongue. Or we detach ourselves from like the countries that our heritage is from. But I also think there's something good from like standing on the shoulders of your parents and maybe having new ideals than what they did. Like my family before me, I love them so much, but they're also very like everyone else can protest but us. Like they have this immigrant mentality of we don't rock the boat. Like when everyone else was protesting for the Zanzadigi Azadi moment, they were like, that's not going to be, we support them, but that's not us. And that's just like not an ideal that I agree with. So I think that's like a gap that I form, whereas there are other gaps that I wish I hadn't formed. Like I kind of wish I could speak with my family in Iran by speaking Farsi, but where there are gaps that we form that we maybe spend our entire lives trying to fill, there may be gaps that we also spend our entire lives trying to dig deeper.
Yeah, I really understand that and I feel that as well. Especially like the gaps we have with our parents and other generations. And it's interesting because I feel like there's a lot of like diaspora cliches or like cliches of like, especially in the teen writing community or just writing in general. I feel like this is talked about a lot, but like cut fruit. And I think in the image of cut fruit, it says so much because maybe they can't communicate otherwise. Maybe the daughter doesn't understand all the Chinese or all the whatever language the parent says. Maybe the parent doesn't understand the things that the child wants to do. But in very small things, leaving the door ajar, saying goodnight, going on walks, visiting places, listening to music, giving the child cut fruit when they're studying, it just shows that even without language, even with these gaps in our understandings and in the ways we communicate, we can still show that we care about each other. And I think that's what makes those little things matter so much, because there's always going to be gaps everywhere. There's always going to be gaps in the way we perceive versus how other people perceive versus how they perceive us. And the only way we can fill that is by little bits of love and little ways to show, yes, we're very different, but here's something we can both take pleasure in.
I love that you brought up the team Diaspora writing community, because Astrolit's team, I think, is pretty much part of it. And I feel like when, just in general, when anyone writes about Diaspora, it always seems like it's coming from a place of like loss or like longing. But I think there's something to be proud of like being from a diaspora, right? Like you're making your own new culture. Like you're never going to have your parents' culture. And I think that's a good thing. You are your own person and you have your own perspective. And yes, there will be gaps. You'll probably never know your culture the way your parents do, but they're never going to know it the way you do. The way you perceive it and the way you see it is so beautiful and unique. I think maybe as diasporic writers, we should try maybe to stop writing so much about the loss of culture and maybe start writing about the beauty of the culture that we're creating within the gaps that our parents left behind for us.
Anything that can be viewed as a gap from another perspective, it's, well, what's an offset of a gap? A hill? I don't know.
Yeah.
And like everything we left behind, everything that you say that we view as grief, we've also grown so much because of it. And I think growth is perhaps the single most emotional or more emotion generating thing in writing. At least for me, I feel like when I read a piece, it's not really about loss. It's not really about love. It's always about growth. It's always about this person was someone and they broke out of that. They became someone new. They learned to love their past self. They learned to love those around them. They learned to love, they learned to grow, and they learned to approach things slightly differently, to see the previous gaps in their lives as opportunities. And through the opportunities that they take throughout the course of the story or the poem, they become someone different and someone they can equally be proud of through it. And I think that is the most heartwarming thing to me, that like to show that after losing so much, after changing so much, you're still you, despite all the gaps, despite all the things you don't understand and you understand now, and what you filled and in what you created, you've become so much more than what you left behind.
That's such a beautiful idea regarding like growth. And you know, I've like kind of realized a gap in my own writing. Like I was thinking about the other day, because someone like, I was going, there's like all these questions that you can find online that like, is like, oh, if you could ask your writing, if you could have a conversation with your writing, what would it be? Or like, do you write in relation to things or do you write like next to them? And I realized like, I feel like I'm always like writing from a place of memory, like something very separate. Like I've almost like given myself as a writer so many lacunas, like I feel like a lot of writers do. We're always writing about something from the past or a memory or something that happened months ago. So I think it's, there's also something to be said about writing from like in the moment, like you're saying, like maybe if we wrote more about things that were happening to us now, we would notice more growth and what we're doing and how our writing evolves and how our experience evolves from just writing from memory where we're given all these missing pieces.